Hello and welcome to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofits, social justice, activism, charities, and progressive politics. Of course, you are listening to me, Ethan Clow, your host here on The Sector. And as always, we are broadcasting right here on CITR, 101.9 FM in Vancouver, on that radio dial of yours. Now, of course, you might be listening live via the computer. They have the internet on computers now, by the way. If you are, you're listening via CITR.ca, streaming every Friday. Well, in fact, every second of the day, CITR is streaming online. But, you know, this show in particular is Fridays at 8 a.m. But, you know, you listen to other shows too. That's fine. And, of course, also via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. And the podcast for this episode will be posted at some point over the weekend. So you may be listening from the future. Welcome. Anyway, we have a fantastic show today on The Sector. And if this is your first time listening, well, just so you know, here on The Sector, we like to talk about the nonprofit world, talking about the third sector, as it is commonly known, getting into the question of social justice, progressive politics, and how to be positive agents of change in the world, which is a fancy way of saying, how can we help the world become a better place to be? More fair, more just, etc., etc. Now, in that line of conversation, we have a very fascinating show today. We're going to be talking a bit about the Truth and Reconciliation Final Report, which just came out a little while ago, and we'll look at some of the recommendations and some of the responses that this of a very important, I think, for the identity of Canada and for, you know, moving forward with the relations to the First Nations communities here in Canada. Also, I think from a social justice standpoint, this is going to be very important for defining how Canada addresses concerns of human rights and dignity and all that sort of thing. So a very important report, very important for the country to, you know, understand this and ultimately to take it all in and really kind of think about it. So we'll talk a bit about that in further detail. Additionally, I thought we should look at some of the kind of sort of roundabout stuff that you get for the new year. I mean, this is obviously going to be a very important time of year for digesting what has come past in 2015. So we're going to look at an article that was recently posted on Forbes talking about the largest charities over 2015. Now, granted, this is the US, but we'll get some useful tidbits that we can apply here for Canada as well. And then also taking a bit of a time to look at prison reform, which is a topic that we've covered in the past here on The Sector, and I think is all the more relevant given today's political climate and whatnot. So we'll dive into that a bit later on the show as well. Now, also, as I hinted at, this will be the last episode of 2015. And wow, has this year been busy, to say the least. We've had, you know, triumphs of many kinds, but we've also had lots of tragedy in this year. We've had some pretty amazing breakthroughs in terms of social justice, technology, charity, and advancing the cause of the third sector. We've also had setbacks. We've had interesting dips and lulls. We've certainly seen a lot of different things with regards to the CRA here in Canada, the persecution of charities, the clampdown, if you will, of political activities. We've seen all of that more or less start to change. We've seen a dramatic shift in Canada already since the Trudeau Liberals took power. We've seen some interesting developments in terms of the environment, in terms of how we're even talking about the issue around social justice. Everything from police brutality to First Nations. We've seen a really interesting spike in terms of how we are talking about energy use here in Canada, investing in green technology, for instance, which of course is also interesting because we've seen the NDP rise to power in Alberta, which is of course never happened before. And that's provoked a whole interesting level of political discussion that we can maybe touch base with here on the show today. Time permitting, of course, we do have a fair bit of content to get to. But as I was saying, you know, it is the holidays. And like last year, when we took our holiday break, we played some music over the show. You know, just a bit of classic stuff here and there, fun things to listen to. So I thought we'd do a bit of that again. We'll play a bit of classic Christmas music and, you know, lighten the mood here and there. It is kind of heavy, you know, to talk about social justice and all that. So we'll see where that gets us. Anyway, why don't we take a quick commercial break here on The Sector? We'll return after this and we'll have all that content and more. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bill and Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Hello, this is Rebecca Watson, creator of Skeptic and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
To make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, on CITR 101.9. So, as I mentioned before the break, we have a fantastic show on today. Lots to discuss, lots of interesting things to dive into in the social justice arena. One of the first things that I wanted to talk about to get a bit of feedback on is the Truth and Reconciliation Report, the final segment of which has recently been released. Now, this is, I think, very important for a whole, you know, lot of reasons. But one of them, I think, one of the key interesting facts of this that relates to our show, we've been skeptical, you know, of Justin Trudeau and his Liberal Party and what he's been promising. What's interesting about this is we can look at how the Liberals will take this report and go forward. Whether or not we will see the kind of sweeping changes that we want to see is, you know, ultimately will be decided in the next little while. But it's interesting to see simply how it's been responded to, you know, compared to maybe how the HarperCollins would respond to it. It's also interesting to think about how the NDP would have responded to it. So, I mean, there's lots of layers to this that we can dissect and talk about. And that's something that I think would be a very great opportunity for us here on the show to discuss. And again, of course, we will invite your feedback. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Ethan Clow, that's me. You can find us on Facebook as well, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. Love to hear your take on this as well. So we'll dive into that. Additionally, there's a really interesting article that was written on Forbes talking about the largest charities of 2015. Again, from an American point of view, but still relevant to us here in Canada. I mean, our two charity sectors mirror each other in many ways. So, you know, looking at the U.S. can kind of give us a bit of an insight into ourselves in many different ways, of course. And then also a really fascinating and I think ultimately very, very progressive change of pace is happening in the U.S., which may sound surprising given, you know, all the election and the Donald Trump and the blah, blah, blah. But some interesting news on prison reform out of New York. And again, really interesting stuff that we can talk about here on the show. As this is Christmas, we'll be playing a bit of Christmas music here and there. But before we get into all of that, let's touch base on the Truth and Reconciliation Report. Now, the report, which has been released over the last couple of days, obviously this is a source of intense emotion. There's probably been no other report or legal investigation in Canada's history that has delved into such tragic and sad information as the Truth and Reconciliation Report. The interviews with survivors, the discussion of those who died, the children who were abused physically, sexually, emotionally. It is intensely difficult to examine this material and come away with it and not feel this hole in your heart for those who were let down by the system and those who were victimized by it. It is unbelievably tragic. And I think it's a very important thing that Canadians are made aware of this and understand that this is not only a blight on Canada's history, but it is a very important thing that we all need to be aware of and understand the ramifications of. It's all too common to assume that Canada is an innocent on the world stage, that we haven't taken part in wars and brutality and genocides. But this report shines a whole new light on that, and it's going to be difficult for certain people to, I think, come to terms with that, but ultimately, the sooner the better. This needs to inform and help us understand how better to interact with the indigenous populations of Canada, and ultimately, the tone and the level of trust and the level of cooperation that will be necessary to make sure that ultimately our future does not become something of a segregated and contentious relationship, of which arguably has been the norm for the past 100 years. The report is nearly 4,000 pages long, documenting what happened to the Indigenous children who were placed in this residential schools program, this government-controlled boarding school, and documents the abuse that they were subjugated to. One of the interesting, I think, gestures from the ceremony was that two chairs in the room were left empty to symbolize more than 3,200 Indigenous children who died in the residential school program, which, according to Justice Marie Sinclair, the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, said is actually an estimate and more likely is much higher, which, again, should give you a lot of pause. Sinclair, along with other commissioners, received testimony from nearly 6,000 residential school survivors over the last 6 years that the commission was ongoing. And it's important to remember that through that difficult process, the end goal of all of this was to finally have a reconciliation between First Nations and the government of Canada and ultimately its people. As Sinclair is quoted as saying, a period of change is beginning, that if sustained by the will of the people, will forever realign the shared history of Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples in Canada. Now, it's certainly very important sentiment, but will it happen? And this is, I think, one of the chief issues here at play. Under the old government of Canada, one would argue that this is likely never to be resolved. How will things be different with a Liberal government? And what's interesting, of course, is that Trudeau, who was present at this presentation, it was certainly not unnoticed that his predecessor had almost no part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The fact that Trudeau was there, it's noted that he was in the front row, often wiping away tears. The fact that he was there to witness this was seen as a great sign of hope by the people at the commission. In fact, from what I understand, applause broke out at the mention of the fact that Trudeau was there. So again, showcasing a huge shift in how Canada is recognizing the importance of this. And again, like, it really needs to be underlined and highlighted that this sort of change was so badly needed. But also, in order for real change to happen in any kind of way or a respect to social justice, to society, you can't simply have it being driven by a one-force entity. You can't simply have the will of the people come in and make change happen. It has to be helped along. It has to be supported. And you need the assistance, the buy-in of the power brokers of society, and that means, in this case, government. And the fact that Trudeau was there, you know, and again, there's political reasons for him to be there, and we're not going to deny that. But the fact that he was there, the fact that he showed himself to be emotionally moved and invested in this, what a difference that is! How much more powerful will this commission be as a result of the government of Canada showing such a strong vested interest in this? Trudeau himself reiterated the official apology that Canada's government gave about 7 years ago, which was actually by Stephen Harper. He also expressed the fact that the burden of the residential school program had been thrust onto the shoulders of the Aboriginal communities, but that now, under his leadership, that this was going to represent a lifting of that burden and placing it firmly in the arms of the government and as a country, that Canada was going to have to shoulder half of that. And in order for it to move forward, Canada needs to recognize that this is not simply an issue that affected First Nations. It's an issue that affected all of Canada, and that the solution will result in a Canada-wide solution, so to speak, which is really, I think, interesting. It's a direct sort of change of rhetoric in many regards. Trudeau recognized the fact that he went to school in a very privileged way, as opposed to First Nations, who many of whom didn't even get that possibility. Those who went through the residential school program, of course, got a horrible version of that. So to recognize the fact that so many of us Canadians who haven't experienced this, who haven't gained any insight into the residential school program, coming at this from a whole new perspective of, okay, we don't know what you went through, and we're not going to try to tell you how to move on from this. We're not going to tell you how you need to fix this. We're going to take on that burden ourselves. And that's something that I think is a very interesting and very important conversation that needs to happen. Just to give a bit of numbers, in a different CBC article, again, we'll have this all linked to on our website at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. But just some of the numbers, I mean, again, it's shocking and it's hard to believe that this happened in Canada, but it did. And again, this is one of those things where we need to be aware of this. This will make us a better nation to understand our past. And again, some of these numbers are just shocking. 6,750 statements received by the Truth and Reconciliation from survivors of residential schools, members of their family, and other individuals. So again, like a lot of really difficult to hear information was taken in. There were 150,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit students who went to residential schools. There were 37,951 claims for injuries resulting from physical and sexual abuse in the school program. 30,939 claims resolved of those sexual physical abuse by the end of 2014. 2.69 compensation in billions for claims received by the end of 2014. 3,200 documented number of Indigenous children who died in the residential school program. As I mentioned, Justice Marie Sinclair says that that's actually that estimation is much higher. A 100-year period in terms of what was studied by the commission, which is, again, shocking. 80 residential schools in operation across the country in 1930. So, again, just shocking numbers. And it gives you just such a perspective on our own past here in Canada. When we talk about social justice, this is what we're getting at, of course, So it's again, we'll have to touch base on this again in the future and see where these recommendations will take us. And, again, what the response will be from government. It's going to be it's a very interesting time. Let's take a quick commercial break here on The Sector. We'll return and we'll lighten the mood a little bit. I mean, this is very heavy material, so we'll lighten the mood a bit. We'll play some Christmas music and we'll get on with some more topics here on the show. Stay tuned.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
A stack of records here, a stack of records there. I got records scattered all over everywhere, but I'm looking.
Discorder magazine has been supporting independent music for over 30 years, and it keeps on living by joining efforts with local music supporters such as Vinyl Records. You can find a selection of Vinyl Records' featured albums on the back cover of Discorder and can support your favorite local bands and artists by purchasing their records. For more information on their vast selection of new, used, and rare music, go to vinylrecords.ca.
We are back here on The Sector, and of course this is the famous Charlie Brown Christmas music. Its actual official title is Linus and Lucy. It's kind of a good little jazzy beat, so let's let this play out for a little bit, and we'll be back with some more after this. And we're back here on The Sector, and that was the Charlie Brown Christmas song, Linus and Lucy, as it's actually titled. You know, interesting fact is the Charlie Brown Christmas special, which people thought was doomed before it even started. I mean, there's a whole kind of backstory about how the executives at the TV station were just like so against that special, and it turned out to be a huge holiday classic. And of course, you know, it's on ad nauseum these days. But that particular song, of course, really kind of like an anthem for Christmas in a lot of different ways. Anyway, before we head on to the rest of the content of today's show, I thought it'd be kind of fun to play another little Christmas song. And this one is in the spirit of Star Wars, because as we all know, Star Wars is the new Force Awakens is opening. Well, because it is actually open at this point in time, close to it, if not already opened. I can't remember. Anyway, no spoilers, don't worry. But in honor of Star Wars, I thought that we could play a little bit of music from the seldom-seen Star Wars Holiday Special. So, take it away, Princess Leia.
This holiday is yours, but we all share with you the hope that this day brings us closer to freedom and to harmony and to peace.
We celebrate a day of peace, a day of
Just kidding. We're not listening to that crap at all. Anyway, let's move on with the rest of today's show. So, at the top of the show, I mentioned that we would be looking at the top charities of the U.S. in 2015. Now, there's actually a 50 largest list, but, you know, 50 is kind of a big number, and that takes a long time to go through, and it's kind of boring. So I'm just going to pare that down and just go with sort of the top, you know, four or so, and we'll just kind of discuss that. And again, this article is on Forbes, and I'll have a link to it on the show notes if you want to go in and, you know, read it in detail. I'll give you sort of the Coles Notes version. So, okay, let's talk about this. The number one biggest charity in 2015. Can you guess what it might be? Now, you might think, okay, well, maybe like a health charity, I don't know, like a cancer charity, maybe. Well, actually, and I think people in the know will clue in, it's actually United Way. Yes, they took in $3.87 billion in the fiscal year ending in December 31st, 2014, the same as the year before. No other charity is anywhere near United Way in terms of funds raised, and also in terms of reach and scope and all of that jazz as well. United Way is sort of a super charity in a lot of ways. Number two, this one might surprise you, but it's the Salvation Army. With all of the negative press they've taken over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, they continue to be one of the largest charities operating in the U.S. In its last reported fiscal year, ending September 30th, 2014, it received donations of $2.12 billion, a year-to-year increase of 2%. And of course, the Salvation Army is actually a church with its own doctrine, which is, you know, questionable, to say the least. And in many ways, that sort of plays second fiddle, and I think by intention, to their more better-known charitable efforts, which include things like Christmas season kettles to collect donations and social services and whatnot. Now, I think we've talked about the Salvation Army before and sort of that questionable ethical, moral issue around, you know, should you support a charity that does a lot of work for social services but is also, you know, anti-LGBT. But setting aside that conversation for another time, it is interesting to see that despite sort of the negative press that they've gotten, they're still number two in the U.S., and that's, you know, that's surprising. Number three is a charity that I hadn't heard of before called Feeding America. It's a Chicago-based organization which provides hundreds of local food banks, not just in Chicago, but across the country. They donate mainly food, and they brought in about $2.02 billion in its fiscal year ending in June 30th of 2014. 8% of an improvement from last year. Interesting. You know, food banks are actually a really stupendous charity to give to. They usually have exceptional buying power, which means that, you know, if you wanted to go out and, say, buy somebody like a turkey dinner or well, a turkey is kind of excessive, but yeah, like, let's say a turkey dinner. You know, you might spend $40 or $50, but a food bank can usually get the exact same thing for, you know, half that. Sometimes more, sometimes a bit less. And that's, you know, that's their buying power. And that's why donating to them, even if it's a small amount, usually can go a really long way. So it's a really great choice for if you're looking for something to give to the holidays and you're not quite sure, you know, who to go with. A food bank is always a very safe and very excellent choice. Number four is Task Force for Global Health, which is a nonprofit that routes donated medical abroad. They stayed at number four from last year with recorded gifts of $1.61 billion, a 2% boost. So again, charity that I hadn't really heard of, but again, I think fulfills a very important role. You know, it's also one of those interesting things with nonprofits that kind of facilitate as opposed to direct action. It's always an interesting conversation to have. Anyway, moving on. Number five, cracking, in fact, the top five for the first time, is St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. This is a Memphis healthcare facility that collected $1.8 billion in the year ending June 30th, 2015. So, interestingly enough, from I think our perspective here, is what didn't make that list. Notice there were no universities, which I think is very interesting. I think in Canada, there would have been universities at the top fundraising charities. Canada, we like our universities. We like donating to universities. It's a very popular gift topic, a gift destination, I should say. And in fact, for any of you people out there who are looking for work in the fundraising nonprofit area, universities are always a great place to start, especially if you can get on kind of on the ground floor and then kind of work your way through the system. Universities like the University of British Columbia, Simon Fraser University, Kwantlen, Douglas College, just some of the local ones here, all have pretty sophisticated fundraising apparatuses. And you'd be surprised just how much what they sink into those programs. They're very well run and exceptionally managed. You know, you would often kind of assume that like hospitals would be top of the list, but in many ways, universities will outperform a hospital, especially in Canada. So that's something to keep in mind. Anyway, so that just gives you the top five in the U.S. And, you know, interestingly, you can look at the top 50 and kind of get an idea of sort of where, who is the best at fundraising. And this isn't too surprising. We've talked about this a lot before, but health usually does very well in terms of fundraising. Education, you know, yes and no. Some places it does really well. Some places it doesn't do as great. Any kind of organization that cares for kids usually does very well. Amongst health charities, you often get a bit of a pecking order. You know, cancer, children's care, you know, things like Parkinson's or MS or many of the other like big conditions also sort of have their own little niche that they fill. And of course, your general kind of social services type charities like the Salvation Army or food banks or Amnesty International, those kind of organizations, they always do quite well as well. So yeah, a bit of a snapshot, a bit of an idea of sort of how things are going in 2015. Why don't we take another quick break here on the sector? We will return after this, of course. Stay tuned.
We all know that the word jazz means many different things to many different people. So check out the real deal on The Jazz Show at CITR 101.9 FM or CITR.ca for live streaming. Yours truly, Gavin Walker, is your host, and I guarantee the straight goods of 3 hours of jazz at its finest. So come on by and give your ears a musical workout, 9 p.m. Mondays. Don't miss it.
Time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
Me, 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 me,
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, on CITR. That was a little bit of The Muppets, and I know I said I wasn't going to play any of The Muppets, but you can't have a holiday show without some Muppets. So, yeah, get over it. Anyway, as I mentioned on the top of the show, we will be talking a bit about prison reform, which is a really weird segue. But we're going to make it work. Now, okay, so prison reform. So we start out this question of prison reform with the news that New York State has agreed to overhaul solitary confinement in prisons. Now, solitary confinement is sort of what it sounds like, actually. Prisoners are locked up in small cells, small 6x10-foot cells, for 23 hours a day, days, weeks, months at a time. This process is used to be kind of a punishment for prisoners. What we have learned over the years from scientific research is that solitary confinement is, by any stretch of the imagination, torture, pure and simple. Human beings simply do not function well when isolated from other people. It by no means helps you reform as a prisoner. It's not going to help you adapt to society when you're released. It's not going to help you change your mind about being a criminal. It's not going to help you reform your behavior in any stretch of the imagination. It's just going to make you, if anything, a more likely to offend person. Additionally, there's also a lot of health factors that go along with it. Locked away, human beings tend to develop a lot of psychological problems. Not only that, but no access to an ability to move around, to get exercise, your muscles don't do well in those circumstances. You also don't get a lot of good food. In terms of diet, you're often restricted to bread, potatoes, or water. And of course, that's not going to be good for your health either. The psychological impact of being isolated combined with a diet that does not nourish you can have very drastic effects both on your psyche but also physically. You can develop very serious health problems that way. Now, when you think about it in these terms, solitary confinement is really nothing more than an elaborate system to, you know, mentally and physically torture somebody. So why has it gone on for so long, and why is it only now is this being revised? This is the result of a lot of hard work by civil liberties organizations in the U.S. They have managed to bring about some changes to affect the number of inmates who are in solitary confinement by at least a quarter, and hopefully bring in a range of reforms that include limiting the time that you spend in solitary confinement to also providing certain privileges like monthly phone calls and group recreation. The idea is that hopefully they can change the perception that you can just throw a person into solitary confinement for an unlimited amount of time on the whim of, you know, a prison guard or something. Obviously, they recognize that this is not going to be the end of solitary confinement, but hopefully it's a place to start. It's part of a 3-year negotiations between the Civil Liberties Union and the administration of Governor Andrew Cuomo, and comes at a time of a lot of scrutiny over state prison systems. Now, when you look at the progress this is making, it may seem small by any stretch of the imagination, but it's actually kind of interesting to look back and see that almost 2 years ago, the state, you know, only really came to the agreement that solitary confinement would be eliminated for pregnant women, developmentally disabled inmates, and any prisoner under the age of 18. So keep in mind, it wasn't until 2 years ago that pregnant women and the disabled and people under the age of 18 were exempt from solitary confinement, which I think kind of hammers home the point that this kind of reform is very hard to get across. The idea that anyone, anywhere, would think it medically appropriate to place a pregnant woman in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day with little to no nutritional and human contact is shocking. I mean, like, it indicates a level of sadism almost, really. And the same for someone who is developmentally disabled as well. It's not, this is not a correctional process. This is about inflicting harm on somebody. So changing how we view prisons as places of, you know, torture for prisoners versus places of rehabilitation, that's going to take a lot of work to get that point across to policymakers, of course. Now, opposing a lot of these reforms is the Corrections Officers Union, which actually has a lot of great power in prisons. They filed a lawsuit in 2014 against a lot of these major reforms that I just mentioned. Additionally, officials have complained that they have not been included in the negotiations for the current set of reforms, and that they need to have more input into it. They state things like confinement policies have evolved over decades of experience, and it's wrong to unilaterally make these sort of reforms, and to do so away from law enforcement officers. Now, what's counterintuitive, of course, is that a lot of the information that we have about solitary confinement not only comes from places like prisons, but it also comes from soldiers who were placed in solitary confinement during wartime. Those who underwent extreme psychological torture in such situations. And when we talk about the idea of, again, prisons being about correcting behavior versus prisons being about punishing behavior. And when corrections officers say they need more ways to punish people, that should raise red flags, because punishment, as we have pretty much well understood for a long time, is not a useful tool in correcting behavior. It's a useful tool in making yourself feel better, as in yourself as in the person who is inflicting the punishment. It does very little for the person receiving it to change their way of thinking. You know, ask anyone who's ever been tortured if they came out of that process a better person, and they'll uniformly say, no, it was terrible. And that's sort of what we're talking about here. Now, some of the milestones that this agreement has established include things like a sentence of 3 months is maximum now for most disciplinary violations, except assaults. The 30 days for almost any prisoner who has committed a nonviolent infraction for the first time, and isolation will no longer be imposed for first-time violations for things like drug use or possession. Now, which in the past has accounted for as much as 1/5 of all solitary population, which is shocking, of course. The number of infractions punishable by solitary confinement will be cut in half, and violations that once gave correction officers wide discretion to impose long sentences, such as disobeying orders, will now have a maximum of 30 days only. Now, despite the improvements, the privileges for inmates in isolation will still be highly restricted. According to the Civil Liberties Union, inmates will be able to make telephone calls, but only once every 30 days from those in long-term isolation. And corrections departments will also begin a pilot program to provide offline tablet computers to inmates, but there are only 30 for the entire state system of like 60,000 prisoners. So that just goes to show you how effective that will be. One of the most unbelievable facts that I've been reading about this is that when you were in solitary confinement, you were let out for 1 hour of recreation a day, which they spent alone in a chain-linked fence. I mean, it's just like, it's just mind-numbingly horrendous, this idea that like this is somehow going to fix the problem. It's just going to make you insanely crazy to be isolated like that and then put back into a powder keg situation, which is prison. If we're, you know, we're not kidding ourselves, you're taking somebody, making them more aggressive, short-tempered, angry, dangerous by doing this, and then putting them back into a situation where they're going to have all these opportunities to unleash that frustration on guards, on other prisoners, on state officials and whatnot. So there really isn't a huge benefit to this. At least now, with the new resolutions in place, prisoners will be allowed to leave their cells from solitary and spend recreation time with others on the solitary block for 2 hours, 3 times a week. Which is not a lot, of course. It's a major improvement over what it used to be. And at the very least, it allows for some social contact with another human being. And again, like it really kind of goes back to that whole question of confinement, isolated confinement doesn't make you more reasonable. It doesn't make you more likely to be peaceful or to have an ability to coexist with others in a way that is not violent or hostile. And yet we're treating it like it does, which the science clearly indicates that that's not the case. It's not even a question of a controversy. We know it's not the case. Additionally, things like food is also going to get a bit of an overhaul. The new agreement says that corrections departments have 3 months to phase out the moldy bread, as it were, and replace it with a nutritious, calorie-sufficient, and palatable alternative of regular food. And again, you know, this notion that prisoners don't deserve this sort of treatment, as in prisoners don't deserve privileges and benefits, they're still human beings. And keeping in mind, we have this notion that prisoners are these sort of like hardened murderers, you know, from The Sopranos or something. But a lot of these people who are in prison are there for minor drug offenses, remember. So these aren't like, you know, evil people. A lot of them are just people who have made a few bad choices in their life and now are being placed in solitary confinement, becoming psychopaths. So these little bit of improvements might be relevant steps to helping them reform and re-enter society as productive members, as opposed to taking time bombs. Now, of course, any talk of prison reform, you know, would not be complete without an understanding of the sociological impact of prisons in general. I mentioned the fact that a lot of prisoners are there on what we might consider petty drug-related crimes, you know, possession or selling drugs. Many of these people would not be considered dangerous offenders in the sense that they're not like murderers or gangsters or whatnot. These are people who have made a lot of bad choices, don't get me wrong, and they're not necessarily nice people, but they're not these sort of hardened criminals that we have in our head. Additionally, we also got to remember that there is the other side of the sociological coin, and that is race and class. A lot of prisoners disproportionately are African American, are lower income people, and prisons in a lot of ways kind of represent a lot of the worst sides of racial profiling, and sort of disproportionately targeting the kind of the poor and the underrepresented in American society. So that aspect of it is really important to remember. And again, with solitary confinement, overwhelmingly, the people who are in solitary confinement usually are African-American and usually have some form of mental illness. This also contributes to things like prisoner suicide rates. And then, of course, when you release these people back into society, in most cases, they receive no kind of transition whatsoever. They just are sort of plopped back in. Many of them, of course, are very likely to reoffend, which then goes into perpetuate the notion that these people are like chronic criminals. But you ask yourself, if you were locked in a cage for, you know, 6 months, you're probably likely to be pretty batshit, you know, crazy. And it's not really a big surprise that you're going to likely break the law of the land again. So, what do you think, listeners out there? Let us know. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet at us at Ethan Clow, that's me. Or, of course, you can comment on Facebook, facebook.com/sectorpodcast. And you can download the podcast, get our show notes, listen to past episodes at sectorpodcast.wordpress.com. Also, be sure to check out CITR's brand webpage, citr.ca. And it's got a really handy layout for looking at all of our past episodes. It kind of replicates a lot of what's on the WordPress site, but a bit closer to the source material so that you can just download the podcast right there. Either way, I update both of them, so check them out. Let me know what you think. Prisoner reform, it's a very interesting topic. Doesn't get a lot of attention these days. I know that John Oliver gave a pretty interesting segment on this a few weeks ago on whatever his show is called, I forget. You know, certainly it's something that I think we need to talk a lot more about here in North America. Interesting to compare it to, say, European systems, which are vastly different. Maybe that'd be a future episode of The Sector. Anyway, we are running out of time here on the show, so I want to wrap things up. Again, this has been our holiday special. It's always been fun to do these shows. We play a bit of Christmas music. The topics have been kind of heavy for this year, but, you know, that's part and parcel of The Sector. We get sort of heavy topics from time to time. I hope you enjoyed the music. And remember, you can get all of that information on what we played at CITR.ca as well. Maybe not so much for this episode, but for past episodes, you can do that. Anyway, as we're wrapping things up, I just want to say have a happy holiday to all of you listeners out there. Hope it's safe, fun, warm, and just in general, everything that you could possibly want it to be. Whether that's presents or good food or just hanging out with family and friends, whatever it is, I hope that it's wonderful and it's very enjoyable. As I firmly believe, you know, we don't get a lot of time on this earth to spend just kind of relaxing and enjoying each other's company and appreciating what we have. So make sure that you take that time to tell your loved ones that you love them and tell your friends what they mean to you, because you may not always have that opportunity. And Christmas is a great time to have those fun conversations. Anyway. We will see you all in the new year in 2016. Again, we'll have, this will be our last episode of 2015, and we should be back in, January 8th. So we'll have a couple weeks off, and we'll be back, you know, here in The Sector pretty soon, so don't worry about that. In the meantime, this is Ethan Clow, your host here on The Sector, saying thank you for listening. We'll see you all in a few weeks. Have a very happy, Merry Christmas, and we'll see you all in 2016. Take care.